So I have the pleasure today of introducing a presentation on outsourced claims management, driving better performance, by Phil Helverson and Steve Gervin. So Phil is a director in EY's actuarial services team, and he's been specialising in general and health insurance across his career. In the last 12 months, Phil has worked for both the federal and New South Wales state governments assessing the efficiency and effectiveness of their insurance operations. Now, because his work has encompassed a range of government monopoly and self-insurance schemes with both insourced and outsourced claims management operations, I'm sure that's prepared him well for today's discussion. Steve is also a director in EY's actuarial practice. He's been specialising in general insurance and the government advisory sectors. Steve's been involved in a number of claims leakage and operational improvement engagements in both the general insurance and government sectors. Steve has also undertaken a number of risk optimisation assignments with a focus on designing effective risk and compliance functions. So thank you, Phil and Steve, for presenting today. If we could all please welcome them.
Thanks, Laurel. I should start with an apology. If you are here to see Peter McCarthy as per the program, you missed him. He was the previous session. I can say Steve and I are much more handsome than Peter. It's not saying much, but we'll take it. We're going to whip through this agenda in the next 30 or so minutes. It's 10 key points there. We filled it so you think we've got a lot to talk about. But basically, we're just going to cover sort of the why, the where and the how of outsourced claims management and exactly why are we talking about it. We're going to give a little bit of background on what we've been observing in the last couple of years around these arrangements. And finally, just give some consideration to a framework to wrap around an outsourced claims management model in order to mitigate the risks. And that framework will be based on some of APRA's work. Now, don't jump down my throat. We're not going to ram APRA down your throat, but some elements of that might be useful that Steve's going to talk about.
Thanks, Phil. So we're going to talk a lot about the three lines of defence model. Now, this is a model that is traditionally adopted by the general insurance market. The first line, which is depicted at the bottom here, is typically the business process and risk owners. Ultimately, the scheme owns the risk, but in an outsourced model, some of that risk is delegated under delegations and service level agreements to the first line, which is the service provider. The second line is typically described as the risk and compliance line, and this is required to monitor the performance of the first line. On the diagram here, this is the second line. It monitors the performance of the first line. Too often what we see is a set-and-forget kind of attitude. So the second line sets the program for the first line, and inadequate monitoring leads to poor performance.
Okay, so just to put a little bit of context around what we're talking about, in terms of workers' compensation, we've got New South Wales, Victoria and South Australia that outsource their claims management, covering around 6.5 million employees or 60% of the national population. In 2012-13, they paid about $2.5 billion in claims payment. Now, that could have come down a little bit since Greg McCarthy in South Australia is no longer paying claims. There was managed roughly 70,000 seriously injured workers, defined as having more than 1 week of time lost. So on top of that, you can throw in the government self-insurers and some of the corporate self-insurers that also outsource their claims management. So you can start to see it is a big deal, and we are dealing with a lot of claims and a lot of claim payments. And that's why the effective operation of these arrangements is crucial. Just very briefly, we're going to have a look at the pressures. Is there any reason to see that these arrangements are going to change in the future? We don't think so. Governments are under budgetary pressure, both federally and state. The federal government's talking always about contestability and competition. So it's unlikely that any government would move to building itself a fully functioning claims management department. on top of the cost, being able to attract, retain and pay people with the required expertise to do all of that would be too burdensome. Lastly, technology is moving at an incredibly fast pace. Customers especially are wanting more and more digital interaction with their service provider, be that an insurer or anybody else. So we don't see it moving away from an outsourced model. In fact, if anything, there could be pressure for other schemes to move towards an outsourced model. Who knows? We have seen similar trends within the general insurance industry, which Steve will talk about.
Yeah, so what we've depicted here is an end-to-end process in the general insurance market. Here we have the process and here we have the shared services and support functions. So the key message here is that in the general insurance sector, virtually every process and function is capable of being outsourced, and it's done to varying degrees. If we look at claims over in this corner, one of the observations that we would make is that the outsourcing maturity of the outsourcing function is quite high. And the key takeaway for us would be the reason why it's so high is because development of a mature second line is actually core to a general insurer's business. When we think of the business, it's often very helpful to look at it from an operational model perspective. This is a, if you like, an end-to-end. So we're looking at the front office here, we're looking at the back office here, and somewhere in between is the mid office. And this is typically what people think of when we think of outsourcing claims. But actually, as this diagram demonstrates, there's quite a variance depending on the model. So on the left here, we have an outsource model where virtually every function is outsourced, except for down here, which is vendor management. Over here, we have quality, and actually that's partly outsourced, or maybe that's not the right term, but clearly the first line needs to have its own quality management in place, but fundamentally what's important is having second line with a robust, effective quality management in place. Over here in the outsource model, we're depicting vendor management, once again, as not being an outsource function.
So why are these companies outsourcing? Oh, that's your notes. Sorry. In fact, if you look at the research, all the reasons are effectively the same. They're looking to improve or reduce costs, increase efficiency so they can focus on their core business, access to specialised knowledge, improve quality. They're all good reasons, and all of that can be tied in to the objectives of the scheme. The objectives of these schemes are mostly enshrined in the legislation. You've got financial sustainability, affordable premiums, optimal return to work and health outcomes, risk management. Or as Greg McCarthy said this morning, affordable schemes that improves the health and work return to work outcomes. Now, also, as Dr. Swan articulated this morning, getting people back to work has massive flow-on benefits to the rest of the community. So there's social impact of these schemes as well. So these objectives are quite weighty and very significant. However, when we look at what your outsourced provider's objective is all about, you start to run into a little bit of problem. So the scheme's got its objectives around affordability and efficiency and sustainability, but your outsourced provider's prime objective is to make money. Now, that's not a bad thing. That's what business is all about. And it's not to say they haven't got good people working for you doing a really, really good job, but it's not their capital that's at risk. And if you set up an underwritten portfolio next to a managed fund portfolio, which one are they going to give it its most attention to? The one that's their capital at risk. So it's not a bad thing. It just needs to be recognised because it leads to risk. And where there's risk, you need to mitigate and manage that risk. So all we would say is that by outsourcing, you're increasing your risk and you need to recognise that.
So when we think about risks, the first category of risk is what we'll call the universal risk. It doesn't matter what you're outsourcing, the risks are the same. So if we think of the universal risks, and we've got some results from an outsourcing survey, dependency on your third-party service provider is the highest risk regarded by parties that outsource, followed by loss of control, impact on quality, loss of knowledge, and information security. These universal risks apply no matter what the subject of the outsource. Then you've got the scheme risks. So that's what Phil talked about a bit earlier, and that is things like the misalignment of the scheme objectives, ineffective monitoring procedures, ineffective management control, and outsourcing relationship. And then what we would say is the third category of risks are those that are around managing complex claims. These are complex claims, so they're difficult to manage. And what this all means is it leads to a mitigation, and we say that mitigation, the effective mitigation, is around development of a mature second line.
Okay, so we're just going to give you some observations. Late last night, I was told putting 200 words on the page and asking you guys to sit and read it for 5 minutes was not the way I should be presenting, so I won't do that. We'll just have some key call-outs around some key themes. So risk and strategy. When we see it done well, and I will say we see a lot of things done well, we see some things done poorly. We rarely see everything done well, and we rarely see everything done poorly. But around risk and strategy, when it's done well, the risks associated with both the management of claims and of the outsource provider is clearly defined. The risk owner is clearly defined and recognised. When it's done poorly, you get to the set and forget mentality that Steve mentioned early. The risk and the owner of those risks are poorly defined and things start to fall through the gaps. It's a similar story with governance. When we see it done well, it's very active management of the service provider and constant monitoring of both claims performance and the provider performance. The scheme continually challenges the service provider. When it's done poorly, a contract is put in place for a fixed term and the service provider is told to go away and manage claims. That brings us to the contract itself, which is probably the most crucial part of the whole relationship, because that is where you can start to align your objectives or at least recognise your misalignment of your objectives. So the best we have seen is flexible and fair and is able to adapt to the changing circumstances within the scheme over time. When it's done poorly, as I said, you get a 5-year contract that's inflexible. When issues arise, you find it difficult to address them because the contract doesn't allow it. In terms of remuneration, a key part of the contract. Now, this is where, remember, your service provider wants to make money, so they're very interested in this part of the contract. They'll do what the contract says if that's where they can make their money. But it needs to be balanced. There's no point trying to skin your service provider. They'll just deliver poor service if you're not paying them well enough and they have to skimp on resources. So remuneration needs to be fair, it needs to be flexible, and it needs to drive the right behaviours. Done poorly, it can be too complex, sometimes designed by actuaries, not always a good thing. If the service provider doesn't understand or can't see how their actions are influencing the remuneration, then they'll just ignore it. One last point is the remuneration should be reflective of the key benefit design features of the scheme. One example of that is around work capacity tests that the legislation may require. I think Greg wouldn't mind me mentioning the South Australia example, whereas they found after a certain time they had about 5% of work capacity tests actually performed, whereas it should have been 95%. They threw a little bit of money at the problem and, hey presto, it turned around and the results got changed. I actually had two slides of 200 words for you. Just with people, done well, these schemes have good people in them with the relevant expertise that know about claims, know about legal issues, know about analytical issues, know about the medical issues, and can provide an effective challenge to the provider. Obviously, the converse happens when things are done poorly. I'm hardly going to touch on IT and analytical because we could spend another 40 minutes talking about that issue. But suffice to say that you need easy and effective access to your data. The scheme owns the data. It's your data. Use it the most effective way you can. When that's done poorly, schemes can't access the data. They can't monitor in a timely fashion, and they can't respond to trends and adverse risks as they arise. Talk about other suppliers in a second. So the contract and the remuneration is crucial. We just got a couple of quick examples to illustrate that point. These couple of things come up all the time. Third-party recoveries, that can be up to 5% within workers' compensation of claims costs. 5% of $2.5 billion is enough actuaries around this conference to tell me that's still a big number. We've rarely seen any contract or remuneration structured around third-party recoveries, and when we go and review individual claim files, we see time and again opportunities that were there to pursue or at least inquire or make the case that a third-party recovery was available and it's not being done. Why? Because there's no remuneration or no contract requirement for the service provider to do that. Legal providers is another story. So again, within workers' compensation, can be 5 to 10% of claim costs. And a lot of the time, the use of a legal provider is left to the insurer. They use their panel, and there's very little transparency for the scheme around that relationship and how it's working. So it's okay, that the setup is okay, but you need to have the data available to you to be able to monitor how that's working. So, yes, an invoice from a legal provider might be supplied in your data, in your transactional file, but what does that invoice actually contain? Have they been briefing barristers? Is your outsourced legal provider outsourcing to a barrister to do the work and being charged at some exorbitant rate? This is the sort of detail you need to go into to ensure you've got transparency and control over the legal providers. And process audits we're going to come back to shortly.
So this brings us back to developing a good second line, and we believe that the convergence and alignment of strategy and management roles comes together where strategy is at the top. Strategy is always naturally at the top. It's the hierarchy of things. But we think that you've got to think of strategy in terms of your operational model, and then what feeds from your operational model is into your risk management and into your design of your three lines, and in particular your second line. So when we think about developing the second line and building an effective second line, it really starts with getting the first line right. As we said earlier, typically the first line is the risk owner, but in an outsourced claims context, the scheme remains the risk owner, so the first line assumes some risk under delegations and under the service level agreement. But what's critical, and this is really captured at the bottom here, and that is the second line must have sufficient resources, be resourced adequately, and have sufficient capacity and capability to monitor what the first line is doing. Phil mentioned at the outset that we don't want to talk about APRA, but actually APRA's got some pretty good stuff. We've extracted here Prudential Guidelines 230 as it relates to operational risk and 231 as it relates to outsourcing risk. And if we go through it, there's quite a number of good takeaways in terms of developing an effective second line. We've highlighted a few here. Obviously, developing a risk management framework is the first thing that should be done. There's obviously a lot of variability in the effectiveness of different risk management frameworks. Continuing down, 230, GPG 230, which relates to op risk, identification of the right human resources. Now, that's not just... That includes the service provider, so obviously having the right resources in first line is important, but equally having the right resources in second line is equally important. And obviously monitoring. If we look at the outsourcing prudential guidelines, consideration of the beneficiary, so this is consideration of the end user, in this case the claimants. Service level agreements gets a big call out. Developing an outsourced team with the necessary skills. So this comes back to the common theme that runs through this, and that is having the right capability in your second line. And management control of the outsourcing arrangements.
Okay, so just a couple of things. Monitoring is crucial to the success of any of this. There's actually a step before monitoring, and that's to be on top of your IT and your data. But as I said, that's a talk in itself. But monitoring, as Steve said, is crucial to the second line, and the second line must own it. That is the scheme owner, the scheme management. So the aim is to identify emerging risks and bring them to the attention of management so that they can be actioned. The risk should be prioritised. How big a risk is it actually? What will the damage be if we do something or we don't do something about it? Once it's identified and actioned, you can't just forget about it. You have to keep monitoring, because if you put a remedial plan in place, how do you know if that's going to succeed or not? None of this is easy. Personal injury claims are complex. There's many moving parts. No one thing is black and white. How early can you really pinpoint an emerging trend in data when there's a lot of noise around that data? Is it really a trend or is it just an aberration? How quickly can you expect your remedial actions to actually take effect? So it's not easy. It takes constant attention, and you have to keep going. You have to keep adapting and developing it all the time. But it's not just about analytics, and it's not just about the data. You have to be communicating with your service provider all the time, ensuring they're doing what you have asked and they're doing what they've told you they're doing. So it requires, as Steve said, a whole range of skills that the scheme manager needs to have. Okay, and quality assurance. There's one key question in our work that's popped up time and again in the last couple of years, and that is the outsource provider actually doing a good job or not? And we can rarely get a satisfactory answer. Yes, we get an answer. Yes, they're doing a good job because of such and such, or we think they're doing a good job, but the actual evidence for that is limited. So what we would say is that you need to be doing individual claim file reviews in some sort of systemic manner. And these are not audits where you go in and follow a checklist and say, oh, yes, the claim was registered within 2 days, pop, good. These are actually looking at the decisions that were made on the file, bearing in mind that none of those decisions are easy, they're not black and white, that they need to be assessed to see if the claim strategy is actually being followed. Again, this is squarely the responsibility of the risk owner, which is the scheme management. There can be a lot of value get out of these sorts of quality assurance programs. They can be for education, for training. They can guide your discussions with your outsource providers. But it does require pretty significant claims management expertise. People, as Greg McCarthy alluded to this morning, that have actually got their hands dirty with claim files and know what they're looking for. If you don't have that, then you do end up with a process audit. Okay, we're going to leave it there. So just the key takeouts from us. The scheme is the risk owner. You cannot abrogate your responsibility. That has to stay with the scheme. Outsourcing can be incredibly valuable in helping you to achieve the objectives of the scheme, but it does increase your risk, and you have to accept that and you have to mitigate that. So proactively manage your provider. Monitor, 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 and then monitor some more. You put an appropriate risk management framework in place. And when you see things arise, make sure they're actioned and managed. This morning before 9 o'clock, I heard this quote twice, don't outsource your brain. And Len Baum said it at breakfast and Greg McCarthy said it in his talk, so I think there's a theme here somewhere. Steve will happily answer any questions.
you. That was very informative. Now, do we have any questions to start us off? Cool. All right. We've got plenty of time for questions, so I'll kick off. So, look, thank you, guys. I actually found that really useful. And as you went through, I know the title was claims management, but it seemed to me that some of those principles could apply across a number, as you've already pointed out, a number of other areas that aren't that are outsourced, where someone else has responsibility that creates risk for you. So I have two questions, not particularly related. The first was you were saying something you commonly see overlooked is third-party recoveries and the importance of those. Now, as someone who's seen sort of changes in activity of recovery actions between workers' comp and CTP schemes, it seems to me that there are things going on out there that drive different levels. So I suppose just curious as to your observations of where you have seen it given attention. The second question I had was around the claims auditing process. So you mentioned that it's useful to go back and do a claims process audit to check the judgments being made. Now, it seems to me that that's quite, I guess, a manual process. So with today's technology and increasingly, I mean, I've come across examples where the conclusion is that you're better off to interrogate an entire database than rely on manual auditing processes. Do you think maybe that's going to be affected by today's technology? Is there a more automated process to get that result? I know that's quite a broad question.
I'll take the second one.
I think a process audit will give you comfort around process. And so one of the themes that comes through strongly, and Phil mentioned it a few times, and that is it doesn't really substitute the actual understanding of what's going on in your claims. It's only when you actually conduct claim file reviews that you can be fully informed about whether or not claims are being adjusted in accordance with your strategy. Claims are being managed in accordance with your service level agreement and so forth. Phil gave a good example, actually. Once again, it came from Greg McCarthy about something. It was around
work capacity
audits were being conducted in 5% of the case, and it should have been 95%. So, anyway, the point is that if you do a process audit, you're going to get comfort on process. You're just not necessarily going to get comfort around the claims themselves.
I think I would just add to what Steve said that we do know that private insurers are investing a lot of money in this and embedding it within their second line of defence. So there is proprietary software out there that goes through this sort of audit in a very systematic manner. I would agree 100%, it's very labour intensive. And it's not something that you would want to have as a standalone tool. I think it's something that complements your analytics that you're doing at the same time. Third-party recoveries, I don't think I can offer you too much insight into your question. Yeah, I suspect you're right. There's a lot of moving parts out there at the moment. I guess our point was just around that from when we've gone in to have a look at claims, we don't see a methodical approach taken to recoveries. You'll pick up one file where, yes, they've inquired about a recovery and pursued it, etc., and you'll pick up the next one that's been ignored. So that was the point I think we were trying to make.
Just one other thing that I thought about. We often see, we come across quite a lot of proprietary software that's used in the market. I think it's fair to say, Phil, more so in the general insurance market, and it specifically enables claims file reviews. And so there's quite a lot of proprietary software out there, and we often come across it.
Thank you. Oh, excellent. We have a question.
Actually, I don't have a question. I have a couple of comments and areas I probably don't fully agree with. my view on outsourcing, so Sam Fuller from Employers Mutual, so it's out there. Yes, we're an agent. We also have an underwriting function. I've spent 15 years, though, in private consulting. To me, outsourcing gives opportunity. It's a massive opportunity to get expertise that you cannot build otherwise. Yes, it gives us risk, but I think, for me, the opportunity offsets that. In terms of scheme objectives, I don't quite think I would say that they're misaligned. I think that it's not in an agent's perspective to actually have a profit if the scheme's not actually operating well. I see a lot of good arrangements in place where we have good service standards and good incentives and the two are aligned. But it is important to make sure they are aligned and to make sure that they're changing and they're ordered correctly and all those things. Where I do see a big disconnect is in incentives for prevention. I think pretty much every system I see where we've outsourced claims management, we've outsourced to a different company altogether the prevention model. It's not in a claims agent's best interest in terms of profitability if claim numbers are reducing, but I think if we had the right incentives and changed that model around, I think we could drive a different change. Just on third-party recoveries, I guess I have a different perspective. So having been in the business and actually seen this, there's commercial reasons why you don't actually pursue a lot of them. For me, the basket of money there is actually really quite small, and there's a lot of operational decisions that mean you don't go down that avenue. I don't really actually see a lot of opportunity in that area in workers' comp. So, sorry, not a question, but a couple of comments.
No, that's good. So I think there were three comments there. The first comment related to risk associated with outsourcing. I would say that we're in total agreement on that. It provides opportunity. It supplements capability. It creates efficiencies. It can be cost beneficial. There's lots of great reasons. I think one of the slides we put up there is why outsource, and all of the things I think we agree on. The question is how you manage that risk, and that's all we're saying. We're saying you've got to effectively manage it. And the way that you manage it is a framework approach. And we look at the third line and we come across this. It's well adopted in the general insurance industry, and we think it's quite appropriate for management of risk in schemes. Incentives.
Yeah, and I would agree on your comment about incentives as well. Some incentives in these contracts were designed a number of years ago, and maybe they need to be had a look at to see if a better design can be come up with. I agree. And we recognise the contract and the remuneration can be designed in such a way that the objectives come closer together and you drive the right behaviour that you want. I really didn't want this whole talk to be about third-party recoveries. So I'll leave that one.
Just clarify, you're not sort of what you've issued around about outsourcing is to say you favour insourcing. You're just saying if you are going to outsource, be aware. Is that the flavour? Is that
absolutely, Robert? Okay. Yeah, I can't see. We've seen just as many problems, or if not more, with insourced claims management. All we're trying to say is that be aware. It creates risk. You need to recognise it, you need to manage it, and you need to monitor it. That's all. And I didn't catch the name of the previous speaker said, there's massive benefits can be gained from your outsourced providers, and that's why you're using them in the first place.
We've probably got time for a couple of other questions, if anyone has anything else they would like to ask. Excellent.
Hi, Alex Colley from ISCA in Melbourne. Just on that last point, have you seen or have you got any evidence that one is better or worse than the other? This is all about risk and proposition, and we think it might be or it might not be, but is there any sort of hard evidence?
So just to clarify, evidence around performance or evidence around management of risk?
Evidence around assisting the schemes to achieve their objectives in terms of return to work and financial management, those sorts of things.
It's
not a performance issue.
It's really difficult. The published data is difficult to get your head around, to analyse it and to understand if it's comparable or not. So there's lots of data published by Safe Work Australia across the different jurisdictions and the different schemes. But you've got different benefit design, you've got different types of employees that each of those schemes is covering. So are you comparing like with like? That's difficult. Our question at the end around is your provider actually doing a good job or not is something we come up against all the time, and that's not just with outsourced providers, that's with an insourced model as well. So, look, we have some evidence. Peter finished his talk before this one with a slide that says the evidence exists, but it's confidential. I might hide behind that too.
Any further questions? Yep, absolutely.
The cost of outsourcing, do you have a sort of percentage as to what the expense of outsourcing? Because a lot of comments you hear is when you see the cost of the outsourcing is we could do this cheaper if we did it ourselves, including actuarial services. So, I mean, what's an expense that you expect? Because, I mean, what you put up there, things like the quality assurance, I mean, they're expensive pieces of work to get the good outcomes. So what should you expect to be paying?
I think one thing, Robert, I would say is that if you incurred 10% more expenses and saved 1% on your claim costs, you would be ahead. The published data is difficult to interpret. You see claims handling costs that are put into actuarial reports. Again, are they like with like? It's difficult to say. As you know, the allocation of overheads is a constant problem to assess that. But one thing we all know is if your claim costs get out of control, you've got a much bigger problem than some sort of unit increase in your claims handling costs.
It's been good discussion so far. Would anyone else like to ask a question of Steve and Phil? No? Well, in that case, I'll ask you all to join me in thanking them very much for a very thought-provoking presentation.